This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Welcome to tonight's event, the F word, romance writing. My name's Maxine Beniba-Clark and I'm your host for the evening. So this evening is event number 6 in the F word series. They've all been incredibly stimulating and engaged discussions, and I'm sure tonight will be no different. We seem to have so many distinguished guests on the panel, but each time kind of introducing them, it's slightly intimidating. So I'll start at the end. We've got Kate Bell, who is the author of the challenging love stories The Yearning and Being Jade, which has received rave reviews and which I just finished this morning. It's great, and it's also available at the back to purchase after this session. Kate's story, Cool Change, won the 2011 Southern Cross Literary Award, and the script by the same name received a highly commended in the 2012 Fellowship of Australian Writers Awards. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you.
I don't need to do that.
Hold it to the end and we'll give one big one.
Let's just move along.
Next we have Beth Driscoll. Beth is a lecturer in publishing and communications at the University of Melbourne, and she's part of a team that recently received a Romance Writers of America academic grant to study the genre world of romance in 21st century Australia. So we'll be talking a little bit more about that this evening as well. Next we have Kat Mayo. Kat Mayo is an avid reader of romance novels. She creates the Romance Buzz, a monthly newsletter for Booktopia's romance readers, and she hosts the Heart to Heart podcast for Destiny Romance, an imprint of Penguin Australia. In 2014, she won the Romance Media Award for her essay, Dear Columnists, Romance Fiction is Not Your Bitch. Recently, she co-founded Trosso, a zine for people who love reading romance books. She runs a blog called Book Thingo, which talks about romance books, authors, and events. So welcome to all three of our panellists this evening. With all the panellists we've started by asking our panellists how they came to feminism, when it first came into their lives, whether they had any feminist role models while they were growing up. So Kate, I'm interested in knowing.
Being a child of the 70s, yes, it kind of absorbed by osmosis, I think, feminism. My mum finished school when she was in year 10, and she went back to school to get her HSC, and then following the Whitlam government's free university policy, she undertook a Bachelor of Arts through Deakin, and I just remember lots of conversations about feminism happening over the kitchen table and in the home, and just remember very strongly getting a message that girls can do anything boys can do, and it was just, I grew up with an assumption that that was how life was. So my mum's family were the same. My aunt had a child out of wedlock and went to teach in Papua New Guinea, and my grandmother in the 1950s ran a haberdashery store while she was raising four kids. And so, yeah, I think I just grew up with knowing that it was just how life was supposed to be. Yeah. I got a bit of a shock when I got out in the workplace, so yeah. It wasn't how life was.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Beth?
Actually, Kate, your story reminds me of, I had a similar experience that I was thinking about in terms of my own mother. I'm the oldest of four children, and I strongly remember my mother going back to study when I was about 12, and she undertook a master's degree in something she was really interested in, and just watching her balance the care of us four children and her own professional goals, I think sat quite deeply within me, and it's something that I've drawn on again now that I've got my own children and trying to work it all out. But in terms of thinking about feminism as a word and what it meant to me, I think the turning point was early high school. And, you know, there's that moment where as a child you have a strong sense of justice, and then as you become a teenager you start learning more about the world and the ways in which justice falls apart or isn't there. And I did this high school assignment, which I gave the grand title of prejudice, and I was looking at all different forms of prejudice, so racial prejudice and prejudice on the grounds of sexuality and on the grounds of gender. And I think that that one assignment was a bit of a turning point in terms of opening my eyes to what was around.
Thank you.
Well, I was born in the Philippines, so my relationship with feminism is a little bit mixed throughout my life. Filipino culture likes to pride itself on having a kind of matriarchal family structure, but in reality, it's quite patriarchal in values. But growing up, you know, similar to Kate's experience, I never felt that I couldn't not achieve anything. So there's a subtle kind of feminism that underpinned, I guess, how my family treated me as a daughter, as a sister. But it was kind of constrained by very traditional values. And then it was only, so when I came to Australia, that kind of persisted until maybe I was at uni. And then, you know, as part of growing up, you kind of question the assumptions that you've had about life. But in terms of feminism as a word, everything I learned about feminism, I learned from romance readers, and that is like the absolute truth. And I actually do know other readers who are going through learning about feminism through the romance community.
I think that's a good lead-in to romance writing. When, you know, there's a number of topics in the F Word series that kind of, when you're given the topic, you think, I don't know anything about that. And so when I was preparing for this topic, you know, I went through writing down what books have I read in my life that could be perhaps classed as romance fiction. And, you know, the contemporary ones were things like The Rosie Project or, you know, How Stella Got Her Groove Back. And, you know, looking into that, what is romance fiction? Some websites or, you know, guides kind of say, look, you have to have a meeting of the protagonist, and then you have to have some kind of obstacle, some kind of sacrifice. But in your article, Kat, you talk about that quintessential happy ending being the only necessary thing for romance fiction.
So. I think it's worth mentioning that when people talk about romance, sometimes they mix up two different kinds of romance. So there's the broad sort of romance fiction that we talk about, which includes books like Gone with the Wind, where, I mean, we can argue whether that's a happy ending or not, but you'd be wrong if you said it was happy. and then there are romance genre books, which must end happily. And I refuse to acknowledge any book that doesn't end happily as romance genre. And I think that's just part of the definition of the modern romance genre.
Are there other, Kate, do you think there are other necessary things for a genre romance book?
Not for genre. I mean, really, it's a very simple convention. You have two people who want to be together, and in the end, they get together. And it's you know, it's perennial, and it's drives such a huge diversity of stories and characters and settings. You know, as an archetype or a shell for a story, it's a brilliant premise. And yeah, I agree with Kat. There are, the genre per se is very specific in that convention, and then you have sort of a blurry edge, I think, where you have other things like Kate Forsyth's Wild Girl, you know, the Rosie Project. I don't know, you could put it maybe in romance genre because it does have a happy ending. So there's you know, many, many different types of books that I think fit in that beautiful blurry edge. And I love that blurry edge. It's great because that's where you bring people in to the romance sphere. Yeah.
And Beth, you've received a grant to look at romance writing in Australia. I know the research is at its very early stages. In terms of romance writing in Australia or genre romance fiction, what's the history? Does Australia have a strong history of genre romance fiction?
Yeah, we do. We have from what I've learned so far, we have a very vibrant romance community in Australia made up of both writers and readers and people who are readers and writers, of course. I don't know, I did a little bit on the history of Harlequin in Australia, which is, you know, a really interesting publishing story. I lecture in a publishing program, so I'm always interested in the how do the books get out into the world aspect of the story. And for a long time in Australia, romance writers had to be published overseas, so tended to be first publication overseas. But there have been more and more Australian publishers of romance starting up, which changes the opportunities for Australian romance writers and, kind of contributes to our own publishing industry. But as Kat and Kate were both saying too, there's one of the things I love about romance is that it this incredible formula that it has, the simplicity of the formula and its malleability in terms of moving into different genres means that it does, you know, there's commercial women's fiction now, which is slightly different. There's the more standard kind of Mills and Boone Harlequin romance that people, the category romances that people know about. There's a whole flourishing ecosystem out there, and it's challenging to get to grips with, I must say. It's the sheer volume of romance writing in Australia is something to get your head around, but it makes it exciting as well. One thing that I've been particularly struck by in terms of Australian romance, and I'm sure this will come up for the others too, is the development of RURO, the rural romance. And I think that's a really exciting development in Australian romance writing. Yeah. I love the nickname more than anything else.
Chooklit.
It's like, chooklit's good chooklit. Too. But yeah, but RU and then another capital RO, RURO. And that's exciting because it's stories about Australian landscape and strong Australian women and their lives on the land, and it's often written by Australian women who have connections with regional Australia, and it's proving successful overseas, and you know, it's a really exciting new subgenre that's distinctively Australian.
Yeah. In terms of subgenres, Kat, we're talking in the green room about things like paranormal romance fiction. Does it go on forever? How many subgenres are there?
There are some main subgenres, I would say. Contemporary romance, paranormal romance. I'm going to miss one now and everyone's going to go, you missed it. Romantic suspense. In Australia, rural romance, I would argue, is its own subgenre. Category romance, which is the shorter form romances, and most of us would think of the Mills and Boone as your typical category romance. Historical romance, oh my goodness, I nearly forgot. it's my favourite. and recently, erotic romance, which is in that sort of blurry area of romance, I would say. I think there are... It's an interesting area because I think there is a distinct erotic romance subgenre that is different from erotica, that is different from romantic erotica, that is different from pornography.
Yeah.
And all those are not the same, but we often talk about them as though they are.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think there's this really strong... I see it as a spectrum, actually. So you have... pure romance or what I call sweet romance, which is your very traditional romantic story. And in that, the relationship is foregrounded. And then along the spectrum as you go, the sexuality within the relationship can become more and more foregrounded depending on which subgenre you're talking about. So you've got sexy romance and then you've got erotic romance and then you've got more erotic fiction and then you're sort of getting into erotica, which is getting more to the taboo end of the things, and then beyond that is pornography, which is completely functional and doesn't foreground any relationship whatsoever. It's just about the sexuality. So yeah.
Just with that, Kate reminded me, there's even Amish romance. So
Amish, yes.
Yeah, so that would be on that side
Amish,
of the spectrum.
Christian,
and
spiritual.
Inspirational.
Rugby league romance. There's NRL romance.
I'm not sure that would be a subgenre. But
Biker romance. Monster romance.
We do have themes. They're not really tropes, but they're kind of, I guess, the fashionable... settings or character types. So we've just gone through, I mean, most of you guys would have heard of the vampire craze a while back, and then we went into werewolves, and then we had zombies for a very little time. Don't ask me how that works, but it does. We've just gone through rock bands, I think.
Rock bands, yes. Rock bands have been big.
And we're going through billionaires, but I think we're getting to the end of the billionaires now. So it'll be interesting to see what comes up next.
And when we talk about feminism and romance writing, there seems to be two kind of primary ways people link them. The first is writing romance fiction as a feminist act, you know, the very act of penning something that is usually by a woman, that's going to be written for women primarily and that features female characters. Mm. And then the second way is the content. So, you know, whether you have characters that are feminist or you approach it in a feminist way. In terms of feminism and romance writing, do you feel that it's been something that has always been linked? Has writing romance fiction always been a feminist act? Or is it something where the authors are increasingly conscious of who their characters are?
Can I just chip in and add one extra element to that, which is that I think reading romance can be a feminist act as well. One of the key academic works in this area is Janice Radway's book, Reading the Romance, which was written in 1984, and she studied romance readers in a small town in the United States. Mm-hmm. And to me, this book was a revelation because of the respect that she showed to readers and the way she allowed them to really tell the stories of what they got out of reading rather than making assumptions about what's in a book and then how it's read. And one of the points that she makes is that for readers, readers of romance know that the activity they're engaging in is looked down upon by some people in society sometimes. They know that it's a culturally loaded activity and they do it anyway. And also, and this is a phrase that stuck with me, they see it as a temporary act of refusal. While you're reading a romance novel, you're doing something for your own pleasure. You're ignoring the housework, you're ignoring your nagging children, your professional life, and you're just doing something that brings you emotional pleasure and enjoyment. And so I think that's an aspect of the feminism of romance too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Kelly Faircloth wrote a really great article for Jezebel on the history of Harlequin, Mills and Boone. And that article has so many great quotes about ways in which romance as a genre reflects feminist values. And I think I've heard different ways that feminism and romance have been linked together. One of my favourite ones was from the Sydney Writers Festival, and this was from Kate Cuthbert, who is the managing editor for Escape Publishing. She said, "There's nothing more feminist than the female orgasm, and in every romance book that has sex in it, the female always has an orgasm." You cannot leave that out. And then Kelly Faircloth talked about how romance, the relationships that romance presents changes through time. And she said she thinks of it as a sprawling, decades-long, intergenerational discussion among women about what constitutes love. Because at the heart of romance as a genre is the way in which the hero and the heroine, and this is for those that are male-female romances, the hero and the heroine negotiate the power between them so that they come to the ending where both of them can be happy, where they see each other as equals. And a good romance cannot have a happy ending without that power play having been resolved at the end.
Mm. Mm. One of the great revelations I had was when I read Tara Moss's book, The Fictional Woman. And she spoke a lot about the stories that we tell about women and how they are so often through a patriarchal lens, and that women are represented in film and literature through a male artist's eye. And even for women who write in sort of mainstream literature, it's still tainted with patriarchal values. And I think one of the things that romance offers is a respite from that patriarchal paradigm. And I think one of the most exciting things that I found being a member of Romance Writers of Australia and being engaged in and with other romance writers is this assumption that women's needs, desires, interests are of value, primary value. They're privileged above every other aspect of those stories. And I just, you know, the whole, the way romance has kind of evolved as being this kind of separate pool of writing away from the rest of the literary world, I think has been a really good thing, because it has allowed women to claim and own these stories and to explore what life might look like if it wasn't seen through a patriarchal lens. And I think that there are new ideas or concepts of what female power looks like outside of patriarchy that are evolving within the romance genre. And that's why I think it's such a powerful feminist act and movement, because it's away from that patriarchal gaze. And even when they get the derision and the sneering and all of that, they just thumb their nose at it and say, well, screw you, doing it anyway, don't care, couldn't give a damn what you think. And I think that's a wonderful thing, you know. It's very empowering for the women who write, and it's very empowering for the women who read, because they know they're going to meet female characters that reflect their conflicts, their desires, their needs, and what they want from their lives.
And I think we also have to think about who reads romance, because romance genre is very accessible to women. And we're not just really talking about women in Australia. So for me, I started reading Mills and Boone when I was around 11 in the Philippines. To be able to read about female sexuality in a culture that doesn't really allow females to be sexual without denigrating them is really incredibly powerful. And one of the ways in which a romance novel reflects feminism is that, even though it doesn't by itself subvert the patriarchy, the heroine, she is responsible for changing the patriarchal hero in many, many romances, especially the alpha romances, which, you know, are very popular when you talk about feminism and romance. So the alpha hero actually has a function that isn't just to be like a domineering Christian Grey kind of hero. He has there's a reason he's there, and that reason has to do with the heroine and the heroine's power to change him, and the power of love to kind of overcome the defects in his character, in his alphaness. So I think, and my problem with some of the criticism around romance genre is that when you just dismiss the genre as trashy or as, a blanket statement around how it promotes the oppression of women, it means that you're refusing to look at why this genre is so popular among women. And I think it's really important that we look at that we treat romance genre as just like any other literary genre. I mean, you don't go and read Lolita and you go, that's a book about a pedophile and I'm not reading it, it's trashy, right? You look at the way it was written, you look at the themes that it brings up, you look at the author's body of work and what they want to say about society, about people, about men, about their relationships. And I think similarly, romance genre has a place in literature. And I think it's exciting that we have people in doing academic work around the romance genre, because it really hasn't been done in proportion to the popularity of the genre.
Yes, I was saying before, for a few years I've given a lecture on Nora Roberts to undergrads at the University of Melbourne, and it's always entertaining for me watching their reactions to reading Nora Roberts as part of a university course, and a lot of them struggle with how to critique it and analyse it in the ways that they've been taught. Yeah, but it's just great. I love giving that lecture and informing them that, you know, romance novels make up about 18% of the publishing industry, one of the most successful and profitable genres. And then I ask, have any of you ever read a romance novel? And, you know, and so it's just, yeah, it's great to bring it into that space where we want to talk about books and the impact that they have on society. You can't sideline romance. Mm. Yeah. Mm. And just on whether the books themselves are feminist, we talked about how the romance formula is actually kind of minimal, and so there is that huge variety of works that are written within the romance genre, and just as they fall along a spectrum in terms of how much sex they contain, there's also a spectrum with some of them having much stronger and feistier heroines than others, and you wouldn't want to lump them all together at all. You know, in terms of whether you, Kat mentioned that sometimes they're seen as being oppressive of women, and I always think of Germaine Greer's comment back in 1970 when she talks about romance readers in the female eunuch, saying that they're read, romance readers are people who are cherishing the bonds of their own enslavement. That's a paraphrase, but you know, we can't say that anymore about romance readers. The genre's come too far and it's too varied.
Mm-hmm. And in, you know, literary fiction, we talk about the bias towards publishing male writers, mm-hmm. and readers reading male writers. And of course, in romance fiction, there is the rise of the pseudonym or the use of initials where the book is written by a man. And we were talking earlier about The Secret Lives of Emma, published as being by Natasha Walker, later revealed to be John Purcell, who's a Sydney writer. Does anyone want to speak to that? I mean, the fact that this has created, you know, a genre where women essentially have, you know, they have the credibility, more credibility, I guess, as writers than men do.
Mm. Yes. I won't talk too much about John Purcell because he works for Booktopia and I write for Booktopia, so I feel like that's for other people to comment on. Also, his book, I would say, is more around erotic fiction, not so much in the romance genre. Mm-hmm. In terms of writing, and we were mentioning this in the green room, I don't actually think you would... If you were a male writer, you would almost always take a female pseudonym if you were writing in a traditional romance subgenre. The biggest exceptions or the biggest subgenres where you wouldn't need to probably is paranormal. Anything that crosses over to science fiction fantasy, you could probably get away with because I assume they're looking for a crossover audience of science fiction fantasy. The other place that you probably could get away with a not very feminine name is is male-male romance. And in that one, that's a really interesting subgenre when you talk about identities of authors, because it's very controversial. I don't know if I can explain it in like 2 minutes. But basically, so for that one, I think that's different. But for example, I would never expect a male author name in a Mills and Boone. There are Mills and Boone authors who are male, but they would write under a female name. And I think there are some married couples as well. They also write under a female name.
Mm. Yeah. It's a bit like the literary meritocracy, you know. Our traditional literary meritocracy is defined and defended by men. It's set up within a patriarchal framework. So all our major prizes, predominantly won by men, well, no surprise, because the whole merit of a literary work has been set up with a patriarchal lens. But you shift into romance, you have a different lens. And that's why I think it's feminist, and that's why I think it's fantastic and exciting, because like I was just thinking, Kat, when you were talking, going to a romance writers conference every year, I've done that for the last five, there are 350 women in the room and about 3 men. Different rules apply. And the guys behave so differently in that space. They're very respectful and almost deferential, particularly to some of the superstar authors that we have, which mainstream Australia don't even know about. You know, we have the likes of Stephanie Lawrence and Gracie, some multi-million book-selling authors, and you put them on a panel and people are going, who's that? You know, so, yeah, I think that lens that you talk about, Kat, is very, very dominant in romance. People have an expectation and it's feminine.
And even like the Stella Prize, which is a prize for women authors, I mean, I struggle to think of when that prize will ever be awarded to a romance author. And I think part of it is that romance, I read romance differently to the way that I would read literary fiction. And until you learn how to read romance, you cannot really judge the merit of romance. And if you don't get anyone who reads romance on a Stella Prize judging panel, then you'll never get a romance there. And that disappoints me a little bit, because I feel like if you're going to have a literary prize for women authors, but the way you judge it will pretty much guarantee that you exclude the biggest genre that has women authors in it, then I feel like maybe that's...
It's missing something.
Yeah.
And I guess we've been talking about romance fiction largely as something that is... that features women, that is written by women, and has a heroine and probably a hero. But of course, there are genres of romance fiction that appeal to the GLBTIQ community. Mm. I know from my experience that romance fiction was a really big thing for the black community in terms of showing a black middle class, you know, and showing that, yes, black people can have relationships with each other, they can have all these kinds of desires. Yeah. What is the state of activism in romance fiction? Is it uncommon? You know, are these kind of genres very small? Or
Oh, no, male-male romance is really big. Mm. That's super interesting to study. I don't know if you guys will study this subgenre.
Yeah, we had C.S. Picard out to the university for an event and really interesting books.
The interesting thing about male-male romance is that it's there's been a debate going on for a few years now on whether it co-opts homosexual relationships. I can't really speak to it because that is not a genre that I read heavily in. But if you're interested in those types of discussions, the discussions around male-male romance and who writes those books and who reads those books, it's really interesting. Lesbian romance, not so popular in the romance genre. Anecdotally, we keep getting told that they don't sell. So if you want lesbian romance in the genre, you need to buy the lesbian romance books because romance genre, more than most other markets, are so close to what readers will buy, and they're really savvy about which books are selling really well and which books just aren't. So, you know, there's a little bit more variety now in terms of not just male-female relationships, but they tend to be treated as sort of discrete subgenres as well.
Yeah, so Harlequin will have separate lines for romance from different, you know, national backgrounds and different particular interest groups. And then in the more general romance component of the genre, I guess, again, there's a spectrum. You'll be able to find quite conservative romances and you'll also be able to find quite progressive romances. The ones that I've read the most, and I was thinking of this when you were talking about initials, my gateway romance, I suppose, my entree to the genre was the J.D. Robb novels that are kind of hybrid crime romance, and they're written by J.D. Robb, but that's a pseudonym of Nora Roberts because partly, I think, to move her into this more masculine genre of crime romance and partly because of market saturation since she publishes, I don't know, 6 to 12 books a year. But I got onto those books when I was pregnant with my first child and I read 32 of them in a row.
Oh,
wow. I can get a bit obsessive and they are kind of addictive. But in her world, you know, it's set slightly in the future and there are characters, you know, it's populated with a whole series of characters, many of whom have different backgrounds and, you know, represent different issues that she wants to work through in the books. And so, you know, I find them quite progressive within their limits. Yeah.
I think also male-male romance, I'm going to contradict myself now, it's becoming more acceptable in the mainstream. So J.R. Ward published, was it last year, a book called I can't remember the book, but anyway, it's the protagonists are two male characters. They've had a backstory throughout the series, and it's called the Black Dagger Brotherhood series, and finally they get their book, and it was meant to be a novella at first, and then she sneakily wrote a book-length novella, so then it came out as a book. But I think that is maybe the first male-male romance book published in the mainstream that I know of. C.S. Pacat is now publishing her trilogy called the Captive Prince series. That is very male-male, and not only is it a male-male romance, it is set in a world where, in a homonormative world, so the normal relationship is male-male, and male-female relationships are looked upon as a little bit dodgy. So I think we might be seeing a lot more male-male romance in the mainstream. I'm not sure that we will get many female-female romances, not yet in the near future, I would say.
And it'd be nice to... I think that's why the space is exciting, because especially with self-publishing, there's kind of been this explosion of new ideas and new concepts and relationships that have always been kind of on the fringe. And, you know, the diversity of characters, you know, different races, even sometimes different species, which is kind of scary. Yeah. Dino porn, you know, Sasquatch, getting kind of weird. But, you know, I think that's the glory of this space, and self-publishing really has been the bomb that's gone off within romance, because it has absolutely spawned so many crossover subgenres, so many diverse stories, you know, different types of characters, and it's given people the freedom to actually explore some of those more controversial fringe edges. And I reckon you're right, Kat, I think that another 10 years a lot of that stuff will actually be mainstreamed. And
yeah, and I think that's the other reason why romance is so important for us all to respect and take seriously and notice. Just from a publishing studies perspective, it's absolutely at the forefront of digital innovation and new publishing models and drawing in readers who become authors. Like, the exciting industry change is happening in this sector, and it's, you know, we should keep an eye on it.
What do you think is needed to bring romance writing, you know, out of its kind of shamed place in the corner of Australian literature?
Look, I actually don't think romance writers are ashamed at all, and I think they've kind of given up trying to convince the literati, I guess, about the value of romance, because they're in quite a happy place where they sell a lot of books. Yep. Their readers are super loyal.
Yep.
And the community of romance authors is actually quite vibrant. And they mentor themselves. So the RWA here in Australia and in the US, those conferences are, you know, they're sort of career-building conferences. And they're very positive conferences.
They're the biggest professional writing conference in Australia, is the Romance Writers of Australia conference. There is no professional writing conference that matches it in Australia. It is it. If you want to learn craft and you want to be at a conference about writing that's focused on that, then that's where you should go.
And I will say, romance, I think this might be changing with the advent of the first-person romantic series, but for a very long time, romance has had this, I guess, convention where the story is written in a very close third-person point of view, and I will say there is no one who can write that point of view better than a romance author. When I read that point of view in even in general fiction, in women's fiction, I'm often so frustrated because I'm so used to the level of polish that point of view is written in romance. So they do really good work, it's just that they don't really get acknowledged for it very well.
If I could pick up on your earlier point, I was just thinking about it sitting next to you, about the Stella Prize. At the same time as romance is flourishing quite happily on its own, we do have these social institutions of consecration when it comes to literary culture. There are prizes, there are festivals, who gets invited, who appears on stage, who doesn't. There's the school syllabus, what students are taught, how they're taught to read, and there's the university. And I think those are some institutions where we can start looking for change and looking for people to develop curiosity and interest in romance and to move beyond a sort of a knee-jerk reaction that's out of date. You know, so I look forward to the day when that happens, but I also hope that that doesn't take away from romance being read for pleasure and for recreation, and I think that's quite a precious part of its appeal.
I agree. Yeah. And when we're preparing for this panel, we had a discussion about whether or not we would talk about 50 Shades of Grey. And Kate said, no, it's had enough press, please.
So sick of that book. Bury the bloody thing.
Yeah.
Oh. I can talk about it all night. I haven't actually read the book.
Yeah. Well, you're a bit jealous. $60 million jealous.
Yeah. I mean, 50 Shades is super interesting. First of all, I don't know that you would call it romance genre. It is a romantic series, and a typical romance book isn't actually a series where the hero and heroine's romantic love plot goes over those three books. Normally, a series in romance will be a set of related books, but in each book there will be a different couple, and their love story gets resolved at the end of each book.
Like members of a rock band, that kind of thing.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Oh, yeah, and, you know, seven families with seven siblings, yep. Really popular in historical romance, right? So 50 Shades, when you talk about it as romance, I tend to think of it as romance in that blurry edge. Mm. It isn't really in the genre comfortably. It wasn't written like a romance book normally would be written. It wasn't really published the way a typical romance book would be published. Mm. And the way it's structured doesn't reflect a typical romance. So Jodie McAllister, who is a literary historian, she wrote a paper on how 50 Shades of Grey co-opts romance fiction and puts it into a structure that resembles pornography. And that fits really well with the way it was published, because it was published as a serial, a set of stories serially. So when you're doing that, then you want to, for each serial, for each installment of your story, you want there to be like a climax, so that your readers have a payoff in each of the installments, but you want it to keep going so that you know they'll come back. And she argues that pornography has a similar structure, that for pornography the aim is that you have sexual pleasure and you do it over and over and over and over and over again. In romance fiction, sex is just there to kind of move the love story along. So once you get the I love you, everything's, you know, hunky-dory at the end, that story is done. You don't get to cycle through it again and again and again. And so the wonderful thing about, and maybe it explains some of the things that people have trouble with when they read 50 Shades of Grey, is that Christian and Anna's love story is kind of done maybe 1.5 books in, but the story of their sexual relationship is cyclical over and over and over and over again.
And I think that really speaks to that spectrum that I started talking about in terms of, you know, where romance, an erotic romance, blends into erotic fiction. And I suppose the one thing that 50 Shades did do was open the floodgates for women to really start exploring what sexuality should look like for them, or what they would like it to look like for them. So, yeah, it's not, I agree, it's not strictly romance, but it's still something we should be grateful that exists, says I, with gritted teeth. Just because it gave people permission, it brought in a flood of new readers, and it gave women permission to start writing stories that focused on female desire and appreciated the female gaze. So, you know, in a lot of literature, you don't get to see men through a woman's eyes, whereas in these books, the female gaze is privileged. So we get to appreciate and celebrate male beauty, and we get to explore what sex might look like if we weren't to be punished for it and we weren't to be made to feel immoral for feeling desire. So, yeah, I'm not a big fan of 50 Shades, but I can see that it has done something good. And if it wasn't going to be that, it was going to be something else. You know, it was going to be somebody else's book. She just got lucky, I reckon. She just bloody got lucky, bitch. I hate her.
Yeah, just picking up on that point about not that last point. A bit back. I think she's all right. I like the books. But this question of access to stories, and for me, one of the interesting things about 50 Shades of Grey is that it was the first book to sell a million copies as a Kindle edition. And for most book sales, it's about 20% these days are e-books and about 80% print sales. But for the 50 Shades of Grey series, apparently it's more like 50% digital sales and 50% print. And that speaks to me of some of the exciting possibilities of romance and digital publishing. You know, there were some snooty newspaper articles, one describing the Kindle as the ultimate brown paper bag, so that, you know, you don't have to be ashamed of what you're reading on a Kindle. You know, for all anyone knows, it could be literature in translation or something posh. But also, you know, it's a great way to consume the latest titles, the titles that you're excited about, a series, you can just get the next one straight away. And I think, you know, 50 Shades of Grey showed in a way what digital publishing can do for romance and genre fiction.
I think it's also worth listening to the conversation around 50 Shades of Grey by the people who read them and love them. So one of the criticisms, so I've read 50 pages of 50 Shades, which I promised to read, but I just could not get past that. But I've watched the film, which I enjoyed a lot more than I did the book. One of the big criticisms of the movie are those really daggy lines that Christian Grey has to say. So, laters, babe. But I think when you criticise that, what you're not understanding is that this is the reason the readers of 50 Shades are coming to see the movie. They want to see those iconic lines from the book. If you struck them out of the movie, it would not be the movie that they came to see. And I think that's one of the things that serious literature types must grapple with when they look at romance genre, and it is that it's a genre that puts the reader first. It's a genre that is very aware of who's reading the books. And so the author obviously has a lot of freedom to write the story that they want. But at the end of the day, they know that it's something that it'll be read, that they do it conscious of the audience that it will have.
Mm-hmm. And really look at the fuss that 50 Shades caused. It's not the first book about sex, for fuck's sake. You know, we have this long, wonderful literary canon of erotic fiction, and the fuss that was made about this book as if it had done something incredibly controversial, and it didn't. It wasn't controversial. But I think that really speaks to the awakening, you know, of that relationship between feminism and romance. I think it attracted a lot of that criticism and comment and debate just because it privileged female pleasure and the hero existed to provide pleasure to her, you know, and that for some reason that seemed to disturb a lot of people, you know, and the fact that this was important in the book and profiled in the book seemed to really worry people, and I think, you know, it just highlights how dangerous people feel female sexuality is and how much they want to control it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And maybe one last question to the panelists before we throw to audience questions. In terms of the readership of genre romance, with literary fiction or general fiction, I remember being told very early in my career, look, the average reader of literary fiction is a white, tertiary educated woman who's over 35, and that was kind of, that's going to be 80% of your audience. Does romance fiction cut across class? Does it, I mean, is it something that is, you know, what does the average reader, is there an average reader of romance fiction, particularly genre romance fiction?
That is something I would love to find out through my research. So we just don't have good data available on that, and there is a real need for, you know, work to be done on this so that we don't make assumptions about who readers are. There is readership studies to date suggest there is a core reading group, and it is made up of women, and they are middle class and older, and that's a group that's, you know, an important group that's worth respecting for the commitment that they bring to culture. But how much reading is done outside that group, I would love to know more.
So I'm not an academic, so I will just go ahead and make assumptions. In my experience, and I think this experience is mirrored in a lot of my friends who read, romance is passed on from one generation of women to another. So the way I discovered romance was through my grandmother's Mills and Boons. The way I kept reading romance was through my mother's Mills and Boons and her recommendations. And when my children are old enough, they're getting the best of my romance fiction collection, but they'll probably want to read the worst because that's just what we do. So I think that intergenerational conversation, I think that is very true. So I think to say that I think that the readership actually goes from about age 12 right till, you know, till death, because I know that this is also very popular for people, for older women who read them in nursing homes and so on. It'd be interesting to see whether the subgenre matters in different age groups. I know for me, I came back to romance fiction after I had my child, and this is a story that I've heard others say as well. They just didn't have the time to read a long book. And the easiest book to read, the book that you knew wasn't going to make you cry, wasn't going to kill children in them, wasn't going to give you heartache, was a Mills and Boon. So I read so many Mills and Boons while I was home with my children, with my first child. excuse me.
I'm the same. I'm not academic either, so... But I can tell you what I see anecdotally, and I'm very active on Facebook, and I see large groups of younger women who are either just starting out in their relationships or have very young children. They love romance. They particularly love authors like Kylie Scott, who do those kind of, you know, stage dive series and young protagonist, new adult, I think is what we call it these days. But interestingly, I mean, I don't strictly write romance. My endings are bittersweet. They're not happy ever afters. I'll mea culpa on that one, you know.
Are they happily for now?
They're happily, no, maybe, I don't know. I'll let you decide that, Ben.
Oh, no.
Sorry, Kat. But I'm being honest. But when The Yearning came out, The Yearning is a story about a young girl who falls desperately in love with her teacher, has this illicit affair, which of course is discovered, and she has to deal with the consequences of that. And when I've been talking about that story in public to people, I've had women in their 70s come up to me afterwards and say, "I loved a man when I was only 15 and he was just wonderful, but he left me when he was 20 and I married my husband." With this incredible sense of disappointment. So, you know, I think, you know, you're right, Kat, the age group goes, and I had a letter from a young girl who was about 15 or 16 who'd read The Yearning and she just loved it as well, and it really spoke to her. So I think, you know, that age range is definitely there. It's actually not I don't think the readership is definitive. I think it's about the themes in the books and the characters in the books. You know, rural romance will attract people who want to read about that connection to land, about women who are using their inner resources to get over really difficult external problems, you know. They read historical romance for different things. So I think that the diversity of the genre is so great, it's got something for pretty much any age group at any stage of life.
I wanted to comment on the just something other than age. In the Philippines, the category romance is super popular, like super, and the category romances that are written in Filipino, Tagalog, not in English. And I think that is because in the Philippines, romance doesn't have as big a taint on it. It is something that is popular but also valued. And the other thing that that is really important, I think, when we talk about feminism and romance is that, especially for markets like the Philippines, possibly India, but I don't really know much about the market for romance in India. I just know it's quite a big market. It allows women, the women authors, to have an income and an independent income and a living. Yeah. And it's that is really valuable. I mean, in the Philippines, people go overseas to work. People with university degrees go overseas to be cleaners just because it pays better. So to have an industry that allows women to be independent by writing or by publishing or by editing is, I think, really, really great.
Yeah. Thank you. We might take questions from the audience now.
Hi. I actually haven't read 50 Shades of Grey, but I'm interested about the numbers that you were talking about. Do you think the digital download was higher because a lot of men were reading it?
Oh, I wonder. Yeah. Yeah, maybe. It came at just the right time. So the first book was published in 2011, and, you know, that was just the right phase in ebook adoption, I think. There was a lot of early ebook activity, but by 2010 it had really kicked off and was making ground, so that helped. We don't know who bought it, but maybe I should do a bit of straw poll, find some men who'll admit to reading it.
Tony Abbott.
Yeah. any men here who've read it? Any chance? No.
My theory is that because it started as serial fan fiction, it was just a natural progression that the first people who would buy the complete set would be people who primarily read
Twilight
electronic work. Yeah. Lost my train of thought, but yeah.
Yeah, so it had an inbuilt digitally savvy audience.
Oh, men, yeah. Men, and oh, okay, so. I watched 50 Shades of Grey, the film, on Valentine's Day, and in that screening, most of the people who went there were couples, and it is amazing to listen to the reaction of the audience during the most, I guess, the sappiest bits and the bits where Christian says ridiculous things because they were in the book. The sense of discomfort from the male audience of having to hear that dialogue was really quite amazing, because I've had to sit through some pretty shitty dialogue just because there was a superhero on the screen. And I didn't sort of titter and make, you know, right? But in 50 Shades of Grey, often you could literally hear people squirming in their seats, which I thought was really hilarious. And if I could have laughed, I would have.
Well, anecdotally, all I can say is I know most of the men I know who are at the gym that I go to have said that they've tried to borrow their wife's copy. One of them actually said that his wife took it off him. And I said, well, that gives you one of two options. You either don't need it or you're a dead loss.
Next question.
Hi, thanks so much for the talk. It was really, really good. Do you think that romantic fiction provides an outlet for groups that are not represented in television, in film, for example, highly sexualized images of women, the virtual absence of normal gay relationships for the longest time? I know this. You were saying it doesn't necessarily apply to gay women who don't seem to buy it. But I wonder if romantic fiction provides an outlet for people who don't see themselves represented very much around them. What do you think?
I think that would be too broad a statement, but I think it does provide a place where you can write those stories and publish those stories, and it wouldn't be super controversial. I mean, a lot of mainstream romance is still pretty traditional. The other thing is, it's the romance community is a place where you can find your people, basically. But I think it would be too broad to say that, to kind of give that blanket statement.
My impression is that we are in the throes of a zeitgeist, if that's the way you say it. I've got a shocking... I just... Because those images are starting to come up in television programs and in film, and, you know, we've got series like Girls... Was it Girls? There's quite a few that I can't remember the names of at the moment. I watched with my husband last year a fantastic series featuring gay women on SBS, and I can't remember the name of that one either. But I do think that those images are changing, that heteronormative, very anglicised world that we are used to looking at is starting to shift, and we are starting to see people whose faces and voices that we aren't used to seeing, they're starting to appear more and more and more, and I'm really glad about that. And I think that the romance genre is starting to reflect that as well. I think that it's just part of the overall shifting that's going on underneath culturally, which is a good thing.
And sometimes you'll see it in a subtle way. So a lot of some of the more edgy, the darker romances were in vampire romances. An author called Joey W. Hill wrote a vampire series that is just... I couldn't read, like, the book because it was just so dark. So I think there's a way you can do it in romance. I think with self-publishing, independent publishing and digital publishing, it's easier to find the audience for those books.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, that was the point I was going to make too, that romance is a community where there are opportunities to tell stories, and it's particularly open and active in the area of self-publishing, and so that can be a way for voices to be articulated and hopefully heard by some.
We might take two more questions if there are others that want to ask.
Come on, guys.
No. It's all been said.
We haven't even said smutty words yet.
Yeah. I said one.
Yeah, you did, actually.
Hi. I was wondering if you had perspectives on whether any romance writing is anti-feminist.
Used to be.
I think that would be too strong. Just as I don't think you could say every romance is feminist, I don't think you could say that that romance genre broadly is anti-feminist. I think a lot of romances reflect the culture in which the authors and characters live. And I think some authors make it a point to challenge some of those values. And some authors, you know, probably
like
don't
really... to reinforce
really,
them, don't they?
Yeah. Mm. Well, they reinforce them, and I think... I don't know that they're doing it on purpose. I think it's just... Maybe it's just not that important to them. Maybe it's not the story they want to tell. I think it's too huge a burden to expect romance to either be a banner for feminism or to be a banner for, like, conservative traditional values. One thing I think... one issue I think that I find interesting in romance is that you almost will never see a romance where the heroine has had an abortion. I actually struggle to think of any romance where the heroine has had an abortion just because she didn't want the child. I think you can find somewhere there's some sort of extenuating circumstance. And to me, that's really disappointing. Because I would think, for us to say this genre reflects modern feminist values, and then not have any heroine have an abortion because it's seen as something that you can't sell to readers. I find that really troubling. But I don't think that means the whole genre is anti-feminist, no.
I think, though, I think you're right, Kat. Romance writers are very aware of their audience and they move with them. So it's probably one of the fastest moving genres in the literary world. So that means that they're not going to feed people characters or situations that they know their readers are going to reject and hate, because that means that they won't buy their next book. So it's a very fine line, I think, with some things. And, you know, my character, Jade, in Being Jade, copped an absolute shellacking from some people in the reviews because she was openly promiscuous within her marriage. And people found that absolutely abhorrent, which I thought was really, really interesting that she was honest and open about it. Her husband knew and he could have walked away at any time. She gave him permission to do that, but he didn't. And I think people's response to that says a lot about our social values around women and sexuality and what kind of expectations we have of our female characters and how much we need them to reflect and reinforce what we expect women to be. And I think there are a lot of romance writers out there that are very gently pushing those boundaries, sometimes not so gently, like me, but those boundaries need to be pushed, and a lot of romance writers are actually doing that. So while there is a bit of reinforcement sometimes, I think it's on female terms, and that's got to be a good thing.
Just to end up, I'd like to ask for our panellists' recommendations. Do you have any favourite romance writers? Are there places that aspiring romance writers should be submitting their work, or websites that accept submissions?
Oh, God. Go to the Romance Writers Association. I wouldn't know. I hate being asked my favourite books or writers because there's just this huge long list and I just don't know where to start, so I'm going to leave these guys to do it.
Yeah, this is your website's so good with recommendations. Yes. Kat, I feel like
go to Kat's website.
I have a list.
Go to Kat's website. She knows it all.
I would say if you're looking for people who are doing, who are writing gender in a way that isn't typical, I would recommend Anna Cowan's Untamed, which is a historical romance featuring a cross-dressing duke.
Wonderful book.
Yeah.
On my list.
C.S. Picat, who we mentioned before in her Captive Prince series. Kylie Scott, who we've also mentioned, recently finished her Rock Band series. That's a bit more traditional, but it's very interesting because she writes really sort of alpha heroes, but her heroines aren't placeholder heroines. So her heroines have their own personality and they challenge the heroes and they push back, which I found really interesting.
Lots of jokes in those. I just read one last
time. Her one-liners are really great. In Mills and Boone in Australia, I would say Kelly Hunter and Sarah Mabry. They write Mills and Boone in a way that if you've never read Mills and Boone, you wouldn't recognise as Mills and Boone if you read them. Ainsley Payton is one of my favourite authors. She's published by Escape.
She's on my list too.
She's interesting because she doesn't write romance the way that I think romance should be written, but I still enjoy her books. And she writes really interesting character types. So she wrote one with a hero who was a male nanny, which I've never read of a hero like that before. I think her latest one is going to have a hero who's homeless.
Yeah.
And then I think the one after that is going to be a blind hero. So I love her work. There's so many, I can't even start. But for one of my favourite historical romance authors is an author called Laura Kinsale, and she wrote a book, and it's not even my favourite book, but this is the one that so many romance readers love. It's called Flowers from the Storm, and it features a hero who gets aphasia, so he can't actually communicate properly, and it is an amazing book, and I think it is one of the most iconic romance books And it isn't a sort of rapey hero book. And if you're the type to listen to audiobooks, the audiobook is amazing. She her narrator is so good. Like, I just rewind to hear his voice. There's so many different voices in romance. It's really hard to recommend them. You can come up to me and tell me your favourite book, and then I'll recommend your romance. It's probably easier that way.
Can we get you to put a list up on your blog?
We do have a list. Bookthingo.com.au/romance. We've got a starter list, and we started that in response to Sydney Writers Festival last year, which didn't have a romance panel whatsoever. And so we got a little bit angry and wrote some angry posts. But that's a good starter set. If you're more into sort of the academic work and the intellectual sort of essays around romance, I would recommend Beyond Heaving Bosoms by Sarah Wendell and Candy Tan. Yeah. It is the funniest romance textbook you will ever read.
Really good.
And then there's a book called, I think it's called Adventurous Women and Dangerous Men.
Women and Adventurous Men.
And there is an essay there by Laura Kinsale where she argues that actually when a reader reads a romance, she's not just the heroine, she's also the hero. And so she takes both sides. And I think it's... until now, people still quote that article because it is such an interesting perspective on how readers read romance. I talk too much, I know. You got me started.
So head to Kat's website, BookThingo, if you want to check out that list. Kate's book is available at the back. Please check it out. It's well worth a read. Thank you for being such a fantastic audience, and please thank our panellists, Kate, Beth and Kat.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.